From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made early on a Sunday morning in October of 1983. Lance Corporal Charles Anderson was nearing the end of his deployment in Beirut, Lebanon. The Marine was part of a peacekeeping force during the Lebanese Civil War. While Anderson had seen sporadic combat, nothing could have prepared him for what was about to happen that Sunday morning. At approximately 6:22 a.m., a yellow Mercedes truck packed with explosives crashed through the lobby of the Marine Barracks, a four-story building, and set off a massive explosion. The truck was driven by a suicide bomber. More than 240 service members were killed, including two men from Rochester, Private First Class Craig Stockton and Corporal John McCall. A third local Marine, Staff Sergeant Alexander Ortega, had been killed in Beirut 2 months earlier by mortar fire. According to the Marine Corps Times, the Beirut bombing was the deadliest day for the Marine Corps at the time since the Battle of Iwo Jima in World War II. Anderson says while most Marines learn about the tragedy in boot camp, those not in the armed forces have long forgotten that day. Did you know about it? 1983. Not even 40 years ago. At the time, outside of an atom bomb, it was the largest explosive detonated in the world. Well, a new memorial in Highland Park hopes to change this lack of public awareness of what happened. It honors the three local Marines who lost their lives on that mission in 1983. Five of their local colleagues survived. One was Marine Corporal Mike Zawacki, who has worked tirelessly to remember and honor his fellow Marines. He joins us today talking about the bombing, how he wants his fallen brothers to be remembered, how he wants us to be thinking about their memories on this Veterans Day, because he is thinking about them every day. He has said in recent years, whether he wants to or not, against his will, that event is always entering his mind. Mike Zawacki is with us now. Corporal, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Evan.
Mike, when you run across people who you don't know well these days, do you think that most people who did not serve have any idea anymore what happened in 1983?
It depends on their age. If they're over 60, they probably do. If they're under 55, they're oblivious to it. And I've always welcomed the opportunity as a survivor that as long as I'm above ground and breathing and walking, I'll speak for the 241 who can no longer speak.
Let me also let listeners know that on that day, there were two coordinated bombing attacks. This was the first one, and then just minutes later, not that far away, there was another attack that killed 58 French service personnel. So just horrific, horrific stuff. Some of the largest bombs detonated at the time that the world had seen, perhaps the largest outside of atom bombs, and a devastating loss for this country and for the world. I know you've done this before, Mike, but I think it's important for our audience to hear some of the details of what you experienced. So you were not in the barracks building. Where were you staying at that time?
I was actually 80 yards away in a tent from where the truck bomb blew up. So essentially it's 241 feet away from where 241 Marine sailors and soldiers died. And that is correct that the French barracks, part of the peacekeeping force, did have 58. They had another truck bomb that went off there and 58 KIA there as well. And one of the things that people don't, or society and don't really realize, is when it comes to terrorism, terrorists, they play the long game. You know, they can often take decades before they strike. If you remember 9/11, the first attack on the World Trade Center was in 1993, And the second most fatal one was, 8 years later. Well, for us in Lebanon, in Beirut, we, you know, being part of a peacekeeping force, you know, we were stationed at the Beirut airport, was kind of the flattest part of Lebanon. So it wasn't uncommon to have commercial vehicles come, in front of our own perimeter. And for months, a truck would come down the Beirut airport and circle around the parking lot of the Beirut airport and then just go ahead and take off. And it did that on a regular basis. So we became complacent with this routine of this particular truck. And what most people don't realize about terrorists is they fight like cowards, okay? And what I mean by that is they'll never approach you face to face. They'll never approach you as a unit 99 times out of 100 because they know that they would lose. And in this case, they would have gotten beaten badly. So they went about in a cowardly manner and calculated and carefully planned this long-term plan to take us out. And the intricacy of their approach, the truck itself actually had like a 12-inch piece of marble on the bed of the truck. So when they mounted the explosives on top, when it was detonated, the marble would increase the ability of the bomb to go up. And our building was essentially hollow in the lobby area. So when this thing blew up, it blew up and out with 300 Marine sailors and soldiers in it.
Now, they knew that the Marines were likely, most were still asleep at that time on a Sunday morning. Can you describe what that blast was like, what it did to you physically, even though you were, as you said, 241 feet away, what it was like?
I'm gonna take you right through that. When the explosion went off, it physically felt in my body as if, and I'll be this specific because I've gone over this thousands of times in my head, starting with at 6:22 a.m. on October 23rd. It felt like half-inch and quarter-inch pieces of glass shards were penetrating from the inside of my body out. I could literally feel my head, my lungs, my body expand and contract as the explosion detonated. There was a first wave of like sound, and then the second was the heat and the force of the explosion. And between the 80 yards between the building and myself and the tent that I was in with another Marine, there was a very dense grove of cedar trees about 60 feet wide and about a couple of hundred feet deep, absorbed the brunt of the concussion from the bomb. And it lifted my body up, and not like an outward body experience, but like literally lifted my body up and out. And the tent imploded with chunks of concrete, rubble, you name it. It just completely imploded. And at that point, my ears were ringing to the point where I felt as though I was deaf, and I could hear Matt Lacey, who was a corporal from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, was in the tent with me, who just yelled out, Z, Z. We took a direct hit and grabbed me off the remains of my cot and grabbed my M16. And we rapidly went into our foxhole. And as we went into our foxhole, the cloud of rubble and soot was so thick and dense, you really couldn't even see. We had to get into our foxhole just really kind of by feeling. And then at that, within maybe a minute of having our M16s locked and loaded and out of what was the remains of a little sandbag window in our foxhole, our first image was a Marine coming from the area of the BLT, the Battalion Landing Team building, with his right eye was hanging out on kind of a like a long corkscrew, and he's completely covered in gray dust. And now you're hearing nothing but muffled screams and cries, and again you're still ringing in your ears, and you can't really see very good at all because it's thick, kind of like the clouds you saw going away on from the buildings on 9/11. But you're in that. And my first image was a young Marine who's the top part, the right part, top of his head was missing, and his the central part of his body was had exploded, and he kind of muttered, am I okay? And as he asked that, I kept seeing these glow in the dark mushrooms all over the place. And as that Marine pled with that, I got down to my knees next to him, and he had just passed right at that second. And as I looked at these white, what I thought were white glow-in-the-dark mushrooms, it was actually human membrane.
Boy. I mean, there's nothing that I can say. As you said, Mike, I know you've told the story hundreds or thousands of times, but I know that everyone hearing it is horrified, and it's trite, but I am so sorry that you had to go through that. And then in those hours that followed, you told reporters last year that the goal that day was just to find a live guy, if you could find anyone alive in the rubble, right?
That's correct. And that the one thing I don't ever want, and no Beirut vet and no veteran of combat ever wants, is pity or sympathy. And my Marine brothers and sailors and the three soldiers that died that day, the last thing that they would want is pity and sympathy. You know, when somebody joins the military in today's day and age, you're a hero when you sign up. You're a hero when you sign up because you're volunteering to be part of something that's bigger than your puny little self, and to be part of something that's greater. And when you hear the saying, you know, freedom isn't free, well, I know firsthand it isn't. And I know 241 men that paid the ultimate sacrifice. So even though we know there's the risk of us dying when we sign up, we accept that risk, And then when it happens, the last thing we would want is sympathy or pity, because you'd be taking that honor away from us. So the biggest thing was trying to find anybody that was alive, because at that point there is literally hundreds and thousands of pieces of broken Marines that literally got blown to pieces out of that building. And they knew, again, thinking how terrorists work cowardly and long term, they knew our routine. They knew Sunday was a day of rest where you kind of slept in. And unbeknownst to them, had they done that on a Friday or a Monday, there would have been at least another 250 to 300 Marines there at 622 eating chow, because our chow hall was in the lowest level of the building. So the opportunity to try and find someone alive, you yourself, you're kind of walking around in a trance, so to speak, because you can't even believe what you're seeing. You can't believe what you're smelling. You can't believe what you're feeling. And one of the most vivid images that stuck out in my mind, that first Marine that I encountered who died literally in my hands, And when I looked towards the building, and there's only about a couple of hundred feet difference between this first Marine I encountered and the building, there was a cedar tree in that grove, one single tree broken right in half. And it was actually broken in a way, like if you can imagine a butter knife that was stuck in the ground, the tree was shaped like a butter knife. And in the first image was a Marine in his sleeping bag impaled by that tree that was broken like a butter knife. So to see that image, here's a Marine and he's in his sleeping bag. He's asleep. The cowards that did that to us did that while we were asleep. And that's how ruthless and how cowardice terrorists are. And because, again, they know that if they were to face us like you would any other enemy, like you had in the past, they would lose.
We're talking to Mike Zawacki, who served as a Marine and was in Beirut in 1983 during the bombing that he is describing in detail this hour, as we mark 38 years since that tragic event. As Mike has said, don't offer sympathy or pity for him, but perhaps a gratitude for the service, because he was there sorting through the rubble, finding his friends and colleagues' bodies. A devastating attack, the biggest loss at the time since Iwo Jima, and the largest explosion detonated not in tests around the world outside of atom bombs at the time. Massive, massive explosion. Did you, Mike, did you hear when the second bomb went off minutes later, not that far away?
Honestly, Evan, I didn't hear much of anything arm bombing, because my left eardrum was actually ruptured. And like many other Marines that day, you took a cigarette filter and balled it up and stuck it in your ear so it could absorb whatever was coming out of your eardrums. So the perspective that I personally had before the bombing and the build up to it, Your radio station has a small antenna tower farm, I believe, still on French Road. So those antenna towers that you have, well, I put two of those up in Lebanon, and one was about 140 footer, and this is back in like June of that year when I built that tower. Then I had to climb to the top and mount the antenna components and the cable that had be connected to it. I had a disc camera at the time, and I thought, well, I'm only going to be able to do this once. So I took a 360 view pictures of the entire Beirut area, all of what I could see in a camera's lens. And I've got the Mediterranean Sea, downtown Beirut, the Shouf Mountains, the Beirut Airport, our marine compound, and of course the BLT is right in front of me where this tower was that I built. So I'm up 140 feet with a view of this. And I often reflect, had I had enough insight, I knew then, looking around, just thinking, wow, we're pretty vulnerable where we're at here and where we're sitting and where we're, you know, where our compound is. But, you know, you really didn't think, geez, maybe I ought to point this out to the higher ups and prove our vulnerability. I think they already knew how vulnerable we were. So my perspective of that, you know, I was actually above the BLT headquarters, the height of the tower. And then to think of the 23rd, the 24th, the 25th, and the days that followed of the days and nights that followed of the first 3 days, nights, you didn't sleep at all. You didn't, it was just caffeine and nicotine and digging through rubble. And unlike what you saw happen in Florida last year with the hotel the condos that crumbled, my Beirut brothers and I, we kind of chuckled and think, well, look at these guys. They have masks on and they got suits on, they have gloves on. And there we were as Marines with our hands and our helmets, no mask, no gloves, especially the first 3 or 4 days, we weren't even eating. You were just digging and looking and listening for anybody that you could hear clawing or scratching or yelling to just get out. And it was just a mountain of massive broken rubble and rebar and munitions and personal effects and anything and everything you can imagine was in that rubble and in that pile.
Later in the hour, we're going to talk a little bit about who Rochester and the country lost. Corporal John McCall, Private First Class Craig Stockton, killed among the 241 who died in that blast. We're talking to Mike Zawacki, who was serving as a Marine in Beirut when this bombing happened in 1983. And I want to welcome in Petty Officer Third Class Mike Bice, who is on the line with us now. Mike, thanks for calling. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Tell us about what was going on in your world that day and what you experienced, Mike.
So I worked in the engine room on the USS Iwo Jima. We're a helicopter carrier that carried 2,000 Marines of the detachment over there. We were the flagship. I worked in the engine room, and when the BLT barracks explosion occurred, I was on watch on throttles. I actually controlled the speed of the ship down in the engine room. We didn't really know much of what had happened, except that something had happened. And we went to general quarters about 6:37 in the morning. And then we waited on the hangar bay for the helicopters to bring the wounded to our ship.
Mike Zawacki has been describing just how devastating that scene was. What did you see, Mike Bice?
So that day, I mean, all I saw was smoke on the beach. Mm-hmm. We were out in the water. Later that day, we took a working group of us over there to help in recovery. And basically, I kind of stood on the sideline with a red helmet on and a shovel, and we just, you know, helped move things and lifted up heavy equipment and stuff. It was a perfect description comparing it to the collapsed condo in Florida. I mean, it was just rubble everywhere and the burning smells, and it was kind of devastating.
Can I ask both of you, Mike Bice, I'll ask you, I know 241 passed, were lost in that bombing. How many survived that we know of, Mike Bice?
Oh, I don't know the number to that at all. I'm sorry.
Okay, Mike Zawacki, do you know that number?
Of the guys that were in the building, it's probably less than 50. Mm-hmm. You know, there was actually one Marine who got thrown out of, this is factual as well. There was one Marine who got blown out of the third floor of the building. He lived in the front part of the building where the truck entered, and got blown out of the building, tumbled through the air, and ended up in the passenger side of a Jeep and lived. There was another Marine who literally rode the roof down and lived, you know. And then there were probably 120 of us within, you know, 100-mile radius of the building who survived as well, you know, being, you know, hit by rubble and sniper fire when we converged on the initial rubble. We were being shot at and shelled by small arms fire from a distance. Plus, we had a cache of munitions in the lower level of the building, which were still going off in the initial minutes of the bombing. Plus, you had magnesium batteries that we used in our radios that were burning and smoldering. And I would like to say this to Mike Bice, a fellow sailor. And I just wanted to thank you, Mike. I know the Navy and Marines, we've had a love-hate relationship. I was so proud of our sailors that day. And I think, Mike, that by the third day, you guys were walking around with bags of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and bologna and cheese sandwiches, and making sure that us Marines ate, or you're forcing us to eat a sandwich. And thankful and grateful for that, and for all your help, especially, you know, coming back on the Iwo Jima. You guys treated us like royalty. They fed us like kings, you know, and so I'm thankful and grateful that our Navy brothers were there to help dig through the rubble and to make sure we all got fed.
I thank you for that, Mike.
Oh, boy.
Semper Fi, Mike.
Boy. Talking to Mike Zawacki, a Marine veteran who was there in Beirut trying to rescue survivors after that devastating terrorist bombing in 1983, and Mike Bice calling in, a petty officer, third class, who served in the Navy and was there essentially in the days that followed that disaster. So I want to take a phone call in a second here, and I want to remind listeners that there's a four-part broadcast series on PBS, a 10-part digital series, and a 9-part podcast series. It's called the American Veteran Series. It is produced by veterans, written by veterans, with veterans interviewing veterans, being interviewed and telling their own stories. The American Veteran Series, again, a 4-part broadcast series on PBS, a 10-part digital series, and a 9-part podcast series. It is available at wxxi.org/veterans. It's important and we hope that you can find it and engage with that, because these are stories, I mean, as you've heard our guests talking about, these are stories that they will have to, Mike Zawacki will take with him forever, but every passing year, fewer Americans are even aware of what happened in Beirut in 1983. I want to take a call from Wyatt in Penfield. Hi, Wyatt. Go ahead. Are you there, Wyatt? Might be on mute. Let's see if we can get Wyatt. There you go. Hey, Wyatt, go ahead.
Hi there. I was a reporter at the time at Channel 8 before I went to work at your place of residence. And before the events that these two gentlemen are talking about, there were two Marines who were killed first in Lebanon, one of whom was a fellow by the name of Alexander Ortega from Henrietta. And I remember walking up to the front door of his parents with a reporter from Channel 10, Ray Lovato at the time, who the two of us literally begged the parents to send us off, because intruding on that moment, that moment of grief, was something we really didn't want to do. But they not only invited us in, and after we'd said to them, please, 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 just do a press conference, get us all, meaning all of the reporters from radio and TV and newspapers, please just get us all out of here at once. And they refused to do that because they were hopeful that all of us, one by one, would understand that their son had not died in vain, that he had not died for some unknown purpose, that he was there because he was proud to be a Marine and proud to serve his family. And those are the things that, for me, on a Veterans Day, really still resonate.
Wyatt, I'm glad you bring up the memories of these men, and I'm grateful for that. Thank you for calling the program. So let's talk a little bit about who Rochester and again this country had lost. So you mentioned Staff Sergeant Alexander Ortega, who died 2 months before this bombing, died of mortar fire in Beirut. He was 25 years old, a 1976 graduate of Rochester's Benjamin Franklin High School. And, I can just sort of build on Wyatt's point there. Any good journalist doesn't want to be in the position to have to try to tell these stories. I think what you try to do is ask if the family wants them told. And some are intensely private, and they deserve that. Others, this is an important moment for them to say, we've lost someone, but their memory should not be gone. And that's what happened in that moment that Wyatt's describing. And that's what happens, sadly, often in these kind of tragic moments. So let's talk a little bit about Private First Class Craig Stockton. Died a week before his 19th birthday during that bombing. Was asleep in the barracks and died in the blast. His brother, Richard Stockton of Chilai, remembered Craig, a Churchville Chilai High School graduate, as an awesome brother who was proud to be a Marine. And that's according to the Democrat Chronicle. And I'll talk about Corporal John McCall in a second. Mike Zawacki, did you know Private First Class Craig Stockton?
Well, personally, no. And the reason that is the whole peacekeeping contingency that was in Lebanon, we all had kind of our own little areas that we were responsible for, where Staff Sergeant Ortega was killed by mortar fire with along with Second Lieutenant Losey. They were in a firefight that day. They were on the outskirts of the airport, and we frequently took, incoming and small arms fire. So the day that Ortega and Losey died, they went back to a tent to get more ammo, and a mortar hit their tent. And Stockton and McCall were part of the BLT battalion landing team, and so they were stationed either at the embassy or at the American University or in different checkpoints, or where Alpha, Bravo, and Charlie Company were on the outskirts of the airport. So we all had kind of our own little areas that we were responsible for and kind of confined to. And I just happened to be assigned to the Mau Marine Amphibious Unit headquarters, 24 Mau headquarters, which was directly behind the BLT. That building was 100 yards away, and that's where Colonel Garrity and the leadership of the 24th Mau resided. So Craig specifically, no. John specifically, no. But there's no doubt in my mind. I pass those guys every day in the chow hall or at the or in the gym or our little makeshift saloon that we had there. So without a doubt, you know, we passed each other mm-hmm. on a regular basis. And John McCall, on the other hand, was a communications guy like myself. And in the bottom level of the BLT, all of our telecommunications ran through there. And there were oftentimes I'd run into other Marines working on phone lines down there, and I can still see John's face actually, and just in passing, you know, talking about, you know, another broken phone line we're down there to fix. Mm. So,
Corporal John McCall was 20 years old, a 1981 graduate of Greece Arcadia High School, was critically injured in that bombing. He died 2 days later at a military hospital in Germany. And again, according to the Democrat and Chronicle, kudos to them. His mother, Mary McCall of Greece, remembered him as an excellent brother who had a wonderful sense of humor, lots of friends, and said, quote, he loved being a Marine. He assured me being a Marine was what he absolutely wanted to do, end quote. That's who Rochester lost, but this country lost 241 that day. And Mike Zawacki, you know, there's been more of an effort to memorialize what Rochester lost. There's a memorial in Highland Park now. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Mike?
Yeah, what inspired, you know, normally we'd go to Camp Lejeune or Camp Johnson, North Carolina, every year and attend the Beirut Memorial, which has been there since 1986. And I'll say this too. In 1986, there was a Marine that was in Beirut with me. His name was John Shapura. That was the last time I saw John, was at the Beirut Memorial in 1986. Well, in the late 80s and 90s, John became a firefighter in New York City, Staten Island, Manhattan area. And then, of course, on 9/11, John perished in the second tower. So when I think of how this terrorism has gone full circle, and I know Mike Bice will remember this, the Iwo Jima, the USS Iwo Jima. So us Marines of the 24th Mau who came back on a series of ships, mainly the Iwo Jima was our flagship. We landed at Morehead City, North Carolina, December 7th, 1983, and everybody knows December 7th was synonymous with mm-hmm. Pearl Harbor. Well, for us Marines and sailors and soldiers that were part of this peacekeeping force, we know that the global war on terrorism started on October 23rd, 1983. And ironically that we come back on, we land on American soil on December 7th, 1983. And I had an uncle who survived the Battle of the Bulge. And when I was a kid, he would always talk about the Bulge. And no matter how many times I heard his stories, I would listen intently because they'd always have a new twist or whatever. And I would just anxiously listen to his stories because of it was important to him. And as time goes by, I realize, like last year, we couldn't go to Camp Lejeune to go to the memorial and because of COVID. Okay. Now, whether COVID you know, coronavirus or whatever was a biological weapon or, you know, psychological terrorism, biological terrorism, whatever you want to call it. There's no doubt that it is. So, and myself and a couple other local Beirut vets decided, hey, let's just go ahead and do our own. We decided about a week out, let's just go ahead and throw this thing together. And one of the next of kins, actually, they both indicated that, you know, 37 years have gone by and they've never done anything here locally. So as painful as it is to recall all of this in front of, you know, standing by a next of, you know, a mother of a next of kin and a brother of a next of kin, while the two Marines are right in front of me, the same guys I had a meal with the night before, as painful as that was, I'm grateful and thankful that I did it, because the mother and the brother of the next of kin had said, I can't even thank you enough for doing this, because they locally no they've never remembered it. So once I heard that the War on Terror Memorial was going up in Monroe County, and I looked at their website and they showed it starting in 1990, I was appalled and quickly lobbied to remind them that no, it started in 1983 with three KIA from our own people, our own sons, our own brothers from right here in Rochester. Mm-hmm. And it's 38 years, but it's as fresh in my mind as 9/11. It's as fresh in my mind as us pulling out of Afghanistan abruptly and in a way that cost us 11 more lives. And ironically, a smaller version of what happened in Lebanon. You had 11 Marines, you got one sailor, and you got one soldier that just died in August. And it was 3 days before Alexander Ortega was killed with Lieutenant Losey back in 83. Mm-hmm. So things have gone full circle, and you can, as a society, we've become more complacent. You've become, oh, well, you know, terrorism is terrorism. It is what it is. Well, I remember writing a letter to a certain media company in 2001. It was August 29th, and it was about terrorism. And I remember on my original handwritten letter, the last line in my letter was, what happened in Beirut is going to happen in America. It's only a matter of time. And before they edited it and, you know, fixed it all up to fit a certain, narrative, I guess, they didn't put that in there. Well, there's guys like me, and there's guys like Mike, Bryce, who see this as a global threat. And if you don't think that they're not within our borders, you're fooling yourself, because they are. We have been, as a nation, pretty complacent over the years, and we have been infiltrated over time, and there are varying levels of foreign and domestic terrorists that want to do nothing but cause harm, pain, and suffering as time goes on. So if there's anything that I can give you from my insight, my wisdom, from seeing the big picture of terrorism and terrorists, you know, you don't have to live in fear. You don't have to live in panic. You don't have to remain hypervigilant. But you do have to do your own due diligence, and you do have to remain vigilant and realize that terrorism, terrorists, and terror is real, and it's within our own borders now.
So let me ask both Mike Zawacki and Mike Bice, you know, we've been talking, and last hour we talked about the challenge for some who have served, U.S. service members, of returning to civilian life. Mike, you said that you think about this all the time. Is there a day that will pass where you won't think about Beirut at all at any point, Mike?
I would imagine it'd be the day that I pass, and even then, I'm sure I'll be welcomed by 240 Marines, sailors, and soldiers that are ready to take me to the next level of being a fighter. I don't see it. You can't have 241 men that you just shared a meal, a beer, and some music with the night before die right in front of you, then spend 3 weeks picking them up, and then spend 38 years meeting their next of kin over the years. And when they show you a picture of their son or their father or their brother, and you didn't know him specifically, but you knew what he looked like when he was whole as a beautiful man. And you also know what they look like as a broken human being in a million pieces. Mm-hmm. So you don't ever forget that. And again, don't need sympathy, don't need pity, just simple understanding that it's veterans that have kept America and many, many other countries free. It's not politicians. It's veterans who have kept America free.
Mike Bice, how often do you think about Beirut 1983?
It's certain things that bring it up. I don't say I carry it every day, but certain smells remind me, burning smells and things, you know, remind me of that time. Just interactions with people I served with, you know, through Facebook and things, talking to them, you know. I'd say we don't bring it up a whole lot, though. It was a really, really hard time, and we were all exhausted. I mean, you just worked all the time when you're out at sea like that, and we were just dragging through this thing in like a haze, and I just remember the exhaustion and just being just dead tired and angry and just hurt.
Mike Bice, what was the rest of your service? Can you just describe what your service career entailed after that?
I stayed on the Iwo Jima. In 1985, we made another med cruise, and we were off the coast of Beirut for a while. We also assisted in rescuing the Achille Lauro, the cruise ship that was attacked in 85, and American citizen was killed on board. And then in 1987, May 87, my time was up, and I got out, stayed down in Virginia Beach a little bit, and then moved back up here to the Caledonia, Rochester area.
Mm-hmm. Mike Sawacki, what about you?
I had when I went to Lebanon, when I originally went to Lebanon, it was when the embassy was blown up in April of 1983, our communication battalion at Camp Lejeune got orders for 13 communicators to go to Lebanon and rebuild comm communication, and then to move out to the airport. So after that whole tour in Lebanon and coming back on the Iwo Jima, and again, Mike, kudos to your guys for feeding us, appreciate it.
I don't know if you remember, Mike, but we actually came back weeks late because the ship that was to relieve us, it was either the Guadalcanal or the Guam, it had to go to Grenada and invaded Grenada and took part in that conflict. And right. In the movie that they did about that with Clint Eastwood, they actually show a picture of helicopters taken off from the Iwo Jima, not the Guadalcanal or Guam, whichever one it was. So, yeah, we were late coming back, and that's why we ended up coming back on Pearl Harbor Day.
Either way, I just we were so grateful to actually be on ship. And, you know, one of my that's ship was always special to me because I was flown out on the 3rd of July off the from Beirut out to the Iwo Jima, and I had a hernia operation on the 3rd of July. It was performed by Dr. John Hudson, who was a Navy surgeon and actually a doctor for our 24-mile headquarters in Beirut. And on the third day of rescue and retrieval, we found Doc Hudson. And, you know, we had to position his body in a way that made it easier for the next handlers to process him. So I literally pushed Doc Hudson's intestines back inside his body for transport. And I always get sentimental when I talk about the doc because, you know, three or four months before that, the man had his hands inside my insides and, fixed me up with my hernia operation. And then, months later, I'm picking him up and his insides, the ready for transport. And after we got back, you know, I had like 6 months left in the Marine Corps because I went to Lebanon my third year in the Marines. And after that, and I remember sitting down with a career planner and in early April of 84 back at Camp Lejeune, he said, "Hey, Corporal Zawacki, so what do you think? You want to reenlist? We'll make you a sergeant. You can pick whatever duty station. You can go to Hawaii, whatever." I said, "Gunny, if you could send me back to Lebanon with a loaded weapon and different rules of engagement this time, I'll re-up. But unless you can send me back there, you know, you might as well just call me Mister." So I got out of the Corps after that. Realistically, you never get out of the Marine Corps. You're once a Marine, always a Marine.
Well, this has been an important hour for so many of our listeners who did not know the story prior. Mike Zawacki, thank you for your service not only that day, but as a United States Marine. Thank you, sir.
Russ, Semper Fi, Evan. Thanks for the time today.
Mike Zawacki and Mike Bice, thank you for taking the time as a Petty Officer Third Class and a machinist mate. Thank you for your service as well, Mike Bice.
My pleasure.
Want to remind you again, WXXINews.org/veterans. So much more there. It's all available. It's WXXI.org/veterans. From the whole team at Connections, thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.